case inside to the good smells. The greaseball behind the counter is arguing with a visa-waving customer and pointing to a cardboard sign reading, "Cash only till computer fix." Packy Boy's computer is suffering the dreaded screen freeze. While continuing to monitor his Beetle at 30-second intervals, Brady plays the screen freeze boogie, which consists of pushing Alt, Control, and Delete at the same time. This brings up the machine's task manager, and Brady sees at once that the Explorer program is currently listed as non-responsive. "Bad?" Packy Boy asks anxiously. "Please tell me, not bad." On another day, Brady would string this out, not because guys like Batool tip, they don't, but to see him sweat a few extra drops of Crisco. Not today. This is just his excuse to get off the floor and go to the mall, and he wants to finish as soon as possible. "Nah, got you covered, Mr. Batool," he says. He highlights in task and reboots Packy Boy's PC. A moment later, the cash register function is back up, complete with all four credit card icons. "You genius!" Batool cries. For one awful moment, Brady is afraid the perfume-smelling son of a bitch is going to hug him. 21. Brady leaves Hillbilly Heaven and drives north toward the airport. There's a Home Depot in the Birch Hill Mall where he could almost certainly get what he wants, but he makes the Skyway shopping complex his destination instead. What he's doing is risky, reckless, and unnecessary. He won't make matters worse by doing it in a store only one corridor over from DE. You don't shit where you eat. Brady does his business at Skyway's Garden World and sees at once that he's made the right choice. The store is huge. And on this midday late spring Saturday, it's crammed with shoppers. In the pesticide aisle, Brady adds two cans of Gopher Go to a shopping cart already loaded with camouflage items, fertilizer, mulch, seeds, and a short-handled gardening claw. He knows it's madness to be buying poison in person when he's already ordered some which will come to his safe mail drop in another few days, but he can't wait. Absolutely cannot. He probably won't be able to actually poison the nigger family's dog until Monday, and it might even be Tuesday or Wednesday, but he has to be doing something. He needs to feel he's, how did Shakespeare put it, taking arms against a sea of troubles. He stands in line with his shopping cart, telling himself that if the checkout girl, another greaseball, the city is drowning in them, says anything about the go-for-go, even something completely innocuous like, "This stuff really works," he'll drop the whole thing. Too great a chance of being remembered and identified. "Oh yes, he was being the nervous young man with the garden claw and the gopher poison." He thinks, "Maybe I should have worn sunglasses. It's not like I'd stand out. Half the men in here are wearing them." Too late now. He left his Ray-Bans back at Birch Hill in his Subaru. All he can do is stand here in the checkout line and tell himself not to sweat. Which is like telling someone not to think of a blue polar bear. "I was noticing him because he was having the sweat," the greaseball checkout girl, a relative of Batool the baker for all Brady knows, will tell the police. "Also because he was buying the gopher poison, the kind having the strychnine." For a moment he almost flees, but now there are people behind him as well as ahead of him, and if he breaks from the line, won't people notice that? Won't they wonder? A nudge from behind him. "You're up, buddy." Out of options, Brady rolls his cart forward. The cans of Gopher Go are a screaming yellow in the bottom of his shopping cart. To Brady, they seem the very color of insanity, and that's just as it should be. Being here is insane. Then a comforting thought comes to him, one that's as soothing as a cool hand on a fevered brow. Driving into those people at City Center was even more insane. But I got away with it, didn't I? Yes, and he gets away with this. The greaseball runs his purchases under the scanner without so much as a glance at him. Nor does she look up when she asks him if it will be cash or credit. Brady pays cash. He's not that insane. Back in the VW, he's parked it between two trucks where its fluorescent green hardly shows at all. He sits behind the wheel, taking deep breaths until his heartbeat is steady again. He thinks about the immediate road ahead, and that calms him even more. First, Odell. The mutt will die a miserable death, and the FedEx cop will know it's his own fault, even if the Robinsons do not. From a purely scientific standpoint, Brady will be interested to see if the debt Rhett owns up. He thinks Hodges won't. Second, the man himself. Brady will give him a few days to marinate in his guilt, and who knows? He may opt for suicide after all. Probably not, though. So Brady will kill him. Method yet to be determined. And third, a grand gesture. Something that will be remembered for 100 years. The question is, what might that grand gesture be? Brady keys the ignition and tunes the Beatles' shitty radio to BAM 100, where every weekend is a rock block weekend. He catches the end of a ZZ Top block and is about to punch the button for Kiss 92 when his hand freezes. Instead of switching the station, he turns the volume up. Fate is speaking to him. The DJ informs Brady that the hottest boy band in the country is coming to town for one gig only. That's right. Round here, we'll be playing the Mac next Thursday. The show's already almost sold out, children, but the BAM 100 good guys are holding on to 12 tickets, and we'll be giving them out in pairs starting on Monday. So listen for the cue to call in and... Brady switches the radio off. His eyes are distant, hazy, contemplative. The Mac is what people in the city call the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex. It takes up a whole city block and has a gigantic auditorium. He thinks, what a way to go out. Oh my God, what a way that would be. He wonders what exactly the capacity of the Max Mingo Auditorium might be. 3,000? Maybe 4? He'll go online tonight and check it out. 22. Hodges grabs lunch at a nearby deli, a salad instead of the loaded burger his stomach is rooting for, and goes home. His pleasant exertions of the previous night have caught up with him, and although he owes Janie a call, they have business at the late Mrs. Trelawney's Sugar Heights home, it seems, he decides that his next move in the investigation will be a short nap. He checks the answering machine in the living room, but the message waiting window shows zero. He peeks beneath Debbie's blue umbrella and finds nothing new from Mr. Mercedes. He lies down and sets his internal alarm for an hour. His last thought before closing his eyes is that he left his cell phone in the glove compartment of his Toyota again. Ought to go get that, he thinks. I gave her both numbers, but she's new school instead of old school, and that's the one she'd call first if she needed me. Then he's asleep. It's the old school phone that wakes him, and when he rolls over to grab it, he sees that his internal alarm, which never let him down during his years as a cop, has apparently decided it is also retired. He's slept for almost 3 hours. Hello?
Do you never check your messages, Bill?
Janie. It crosses his mind to tell her the battery in his cell phone died, but lying is no way to start a relationship, even one of the day-at-a-time variety. And that's not the important thing. Her voice is blurry and hoarse, as if she's been shouting or crying. He sits up. What's wrong?
My mother had a stroke this morning. I'm at Warsaw County Memorial Hospital. That's the one closest to Sunny Acres.
He swings his feet out onto the floor. Christ, Janie, how bad is it?
Bad. I've called my Aunt Charlotte in Cincinnati and Uncle Henry in Tampa. They're both coming. Aunt Charlotte will undoubtedly drag my cousin Holly along.
She laughs, but the sound has no humor in it.
Of course they're coming. It's that old saying about following the money.
Do you want me to come?
Of course, but I don't know how I'd explain you to them. I can't very well introduce you as the man I hopped into bed with almost as soon as I met him. And if I tell them I hired you to investigate Ollie's death, it's apt to show up on one of Uncle Henry's kids' Facebook pages before midnight. When it comes to gossip, Uncle Henry's worse than Aunt Charlotte, but neither one of them is exactly a model of discretion. At least Holly's just weird. She takes a deep, watery breath. God, I could sure use a friendly face right now. I haven't seen Charlotte and Henry in years. Neither of them showed up at Ollie's funeral, and they sure haven't made any effort to keep up with my life.
Hodges thinks it over and says, I'm a friend, that's all. I used to work for the Vigilant Security Company in Sugar Heights. You met me when you came back to inventory your sister's things and take care of the will with the lawyer. Chum.
Shron. She takes a deep, watery breath. That could work.
It will. When it comes to spinning stories, no one can do it with a straighter face than a cop. I'm on my way.
But don't you have things to take care of in the city? To investigate?
Nothing that won't wait. It'll take me an hour to get there, with Saturday traffic maybe even less.
Thank you, Bill, with all my heart. If I'm not in the lobby...
I'll find you. I'm a trained detective. He's slipping into his shoes.
I think if you're coming, you better bring a change of clothes. I've rented 3 rooms in the Holiday Inn down the street. I'll rent one for you as well. The advantages of having money, not to mention an Amex Platinum card.
Janie, it's an easy drive back to the city.
Sure, but she might die. If it happens today or tonight, I'm really going to need a friend. For the... you know, the... tears catch her, and she can't finish.
Hodges doesn't need her to, because he knows what she means. For the arrangement. 10 minutes later, he's on the road, headed east towards Sunny Acres and Warsaw County Memorial. He expects to find Janie in the ICU waiting room, but she's outside sitting on the bumper of a parked ambulance. She gets into his Toyota when he pulls up beside her, and one look at her drawn face and socketed eyes tells him everything he needs to know. She holds together until he parks in the visitor's lot, then breaks down. Hodges takes her in his arms. She tells him that Elizabeth Wharton passed from the world at 3:15 Central Daylight Time. About the same time I was putting on my shoes, Hodges thinks, and hugs her tighter.
23. Little League season is in full swing, and Brady spends that sunny Saturday afternoon at McGinnis Park where a full slate of games is being played on 3 fields. The afternoon is warm, and business is brisk. Lots of tweeny bop girls have come to watch their little brothers do battle, and as they stand in line waiting for their ice cream, the only thing they seem to be talking about, the only thing Brady hears them talking about anyway, is the upcoming Round Here concert at the Mac. It seems they are all going. Brady has decided that he will go too. He just needs to dope out a way to get in wearing his special vest, the one loaded with the ball bearings and blocks of plastic explosive. My final bow, he thinks, a headline for the ages. The thought improves his mood. So does selling out his entire truckload of goodies. Even the juicy sticks are gone by 4:00. Back at the ice cream factory, he hands the keys over to Shirley Orton, who never seems to leave, and asks if he can switch with Rudy Stanhope, who's down for the Sunday afternoon shift. Sundays, always assuming the weather cooperates, are busy days, with Loeb's 3 trucks working not just McGinnis, but the city's other 4 large parks. He accompanies his request with the boyishly winning smile Shirley is a sucker for. In other words, Shirley says, you want 2 afternoons off in a row. You got it. He explains that his mother wants to visit her brother, which means at least 1 overnight and possibly 2. There is no brother, of course, and when it comes to trips, the only one his mother is interested in making these days is the scenic tour that takes her from the couch to the liquor cabinet and back to the couch. I'm sure Rudy will say okay. Don't you want to call him yourself? If the request comes from you, it's a done deal.
The bitch giggles, which puts acres of flesh in rather disturbing motion. She makes the call while Brady's changing into his street clothes. Rudy is happy to give up his Sunday shift and take Brady's on Tuesday. This gives Brady 2 free afternoons to stake out Zoni's Go-Mart, and 2 should be enough. If the girl doesn't show up with the dog on either day, he'll call in sick on Wednesday. If he has to, but he doesn't think it will take that long. After leaving Loeb's, Brady does a little Krogering of his own. He picks up 6 items they need, staples like eggs, milk, butter, and cocoa puffs, then swings by the meat counter and picks up a pound of hamburger. 90% lean. Nothing but the best for Odell's last meal. At home, he opens the garage and unloads everything he bought at Garden World, being careful to put the canisters of Gopher Go on a high shelf. His mother rarely comes out here, but it doesn't do to take chances. There's a mini-fridge under the work table. Brady got it at a yard sale for $7, a total steal. It's where he keeps his soft drinks. He stows the package of hamburger behind the Cokes and Mountain Dews, then totes the rest of the groceries inside. What he finds in the kitchen is delightful. His mother shaking paprika over a tuna salad that actually looks tasty. She catches his look and laughs. I wanted to make up for the lasagna. I'm sorry about that, but I was just so tired. So drunk is what you were, he thinks, but at least she hasn't given up entirely. She pouts her lips, freshly dressed in lipstick. Give Mommy a kiss, honey boy. Honey boy puts his arms around her and gives her a lingering kiss. Her lipstick tastes of something sweet. Then she slaps him briskly on the ass and tells him to go down and play with his computers until dinner's ready. Brady leaves the cop a brief one-sentence message. I'm going to fuck you up, Grandpa. Then he plays Resident Evil until his mother calls him to dinner. The tuna salad is great, and he has two helpings. She actually can cook when she wants, and he says nothing as she pours the first drink of the evening, an extra big one to make up for the two or three smaller ones she denied herself that afternoon. By 9 o'clock, she's snoring on the couch again. Brady uses the opportunity to go online and learn all about the upcoming Round Here concert. He watches a YouTube video where a giggle of girls discusses which of the five boys is the hottest. The consensus is Cam, who sings lead on Look Me in My Eyes, a piece of audio vomit Brady vaguely recalls hearing on the radio last year. He imagines those laughing faces torn apart by ball bearings, those identical guest jeans in burning tatters. Later, after he's helped his mother up to bed and he's sure she's totally conked, he gets the hamburger, puts it in a bowl, and mixes in 2 cups of Gopher Go. If that isn't enough to kill Odell, he'll run the goddamn mud over with the ice cream truck. This thought makes him snicker. He puts the poison hamburger in a baggie and stows it back in the mini-fridge, taking care to hide it behind the cans of soda again. He also takes care to wash both his hands and the mixing bowl in plenty of hot, soapy water. That night, Brady sleeps well. There are no headaches and no dreams about his dead brother. 24. Hodges and Janie are loaned a phone-friendly room down the hall from the hospital lobby, and there they split up the death work. He's the one who gets in touch with the funeral home. Soames, the same one that handled Olivia Trelawney's exit rites, and make sure the hospital is prepared to release the body when the hearse arrives. Janie, using her iPad with a casual efficiency Hodges envies, downloads an obituary form from the city paper. She fills it out quickly, speaking occasionally under her breath as she does so. Once Hodges hears her murmur the phrase, in lieu of flowers. When the obit's emailed back, she produces her mother's address book from her purse and begins making calls to the old lady's few remaining friends. She's warm with them, and calm, but also quick. Her voice wavers only once while she's talking to Althea Green, her mother's nurse and closest companion for almost 10 years. By 6 o'clock, roughly the same time Brady Hartsfield arrives home to find his mother putting the finishing touches on her tuna salad, most of the T's have been crossed and the I's dotted. At 6:50, a white Cadillac hearse pulls into the hospital drive and rolls around back. The guys inside know where to go. They've been here plenty of times. Janie looks at Hodges, her face pale, her mouth trembling. I'm not sure I can. I'll take care of it. The transaction is like any other, really. He gives the mortician and his assistant a signed death certificate. They give him a receipt. He thinks, I could be buying a car. When he comes back to the hospital lobby, he spies Janie outside, once more sitting on the bumper of the ambulance. He sits down next to her and takes her hand. She squeezes his fingers hard. They watch the white hearse until it's out of sight. Then he leads her back to his car, and they drive the two blocks to the Holiday Inn. Henry Seroy, a fat man with a moist handshake, shows up at 8. Charlotte Gibney appears an hour later, herding an overloaded bellman ahead of her and complaining about the terrible service on her flight and the crying babies, she says. You don't want to know. They don't, but she tells them anyway. She's as skinny as her brother is fat and regards Hodges with a watery, suspicious eye. Lurking by Aunt Charlotte's side is her daughter Holly, a spinster roughly Janie's age, but with none of Janie's looks. Holly Gibney never speaks above a mutter and seems to have a problem making eye contact.
I want to see Betty, Aunt Charlotte announces after a brief dry embrace with her niece. It's as if she thinks Mrs. Wharton might be laid out in the motel lobby, lilies at her head and carnations at her feet. Janie explains that the body has already been transported to Soames' funeral home in the city, where Elizabeth Wharton's earthly remains will be cremated on Wednesday afternoon after a viewing on Tuesday and a brief non-denominational service on Wednesday morning.
Cremation is barbaric, Uncle Henry announces.
Everything these two say seems to be an announcement.
It's what she wanted. Janie speaks quietly, politely, but Hodges observes the color rising in her cheeks.
He thinks there may be trouble. Perhaps a demand to see a written document specifying cremation over burial, but they hold their peace. Perhaps they're remembering all those millions Janie inherited from her sister, money that is Janie's to share, or not. Uncle Henry and Aunt Charlotte might even be considering all the visits they did not make to their elderly sister during her final suffering years. The visits Mrs. Wharton got during those years were made by Olivia, whom Aunt Charlotte does not mention by name, only calling her the one with the problems. And of course it was Janie, still hurting from her abusive marriage and rancorous divorce, who was there at the end. The five of them have a late dinner in the almost deserted Holiday Inn dining room. From the speakers overhead, Herb Alpert toots his horn. Aunt Charlotte has a salad and complains about the dressing, which she has specified should come on the side. They can put it in a little pitcher. But bottled from the supermarket is still bottled from the supermarket, she announces. Her muttering daughter orders something that sounds like sneeze bagel hellbun. It turns out to be a cheeseburger well done. Uncle Henry opts for fettuccine Alfredo and sucks it down with the efficiency of a high-powered rinse and vac, fine droplets of perspiration appearing on his forehead as he approaches the finish line. He sops up the remains of the sauce with a chunk of buttered bread. Hodges does most of the talking, recounting stories from his days with Vigilant Guard Service. The job is fictional, but the stories are mostly true, adapted from his years as a cop. He tells them about the burglar who got caught trying to squirm through a basement window and lost his pants in his efforts to wriggle free. This earns a small smile from Holly. The 12-year-old boy who stood behind his bedroom door and cold-cocked a home invader with his baseball bat. The housekeeper who stole several pieces of her employer's jewelry only to have them drop out of her underwear while she served dinner. There are darker stories, many of them, that he keeps to himself. Over dessert, which Hodges skips, Uncle Henry's unapologetic gluttony serving as a minatory power of example, Janie invites the new arrivals to stay at the house in Sugar Heights starting tomorrow, and the three of them toddle off to their prepaid rooms. Charlotte and Henry seem cheered by the prospect of inspecting at first hand just how the other half lives. As for Holly, who knows? The newcomers' rooms are on the first floor. Janie and Hodges are on the third. As they reach the side-by-side doors, she asks if he will sleep with her.
No sex, she says. I never felt less sexy in my life. Basically, I just don't want to be alone.
That's okay with Hodges. He doubts if he would be capable of getting up to Dickens anyway. His stomach and leg muscles are still sore from last night, and he reminds himself, last night she did almost all the work. Once they're beneath the coverlet, she snuggles up to him. He can hardly believe the warmth and firmness of her. The theirness of her. It's true he feels no desire at the moment, but he's glad the old lady had the courtesy to stroke out after he got his ashes hauled rather than before. Not very nice, but there it is. Corrine, his ex, used to say that men were born with a shitty bone.
She pillows her head on his shoulder. I'm so glad you came.
Me too. It's the absolute truth.
Do you think they know we're in bed together?
Hodges considers. Aunt Charlotte knows, but she'd know even if we weren't.
Then you can be sure of that because you're a trained...
Right. Go to sleep, Janie. She does, but when he wakes up in the early hours of the morning needing to use the toilet, she's sitting by the window looking out at the parking lot and crying. He puts a hand on her shoulder. She looks up.
I woke you. I'm sorry.
Nah, this is my usual 3 a.m. pee muster. Are you all right?
Yes.
Yeah. She smiles, then wipes at her eyes with her fisted hands like a child.
Just hating on myself for shipping Mom off to Sunny Acres.
But she wanted to go, you said.
Yes, she did. It doesn't seem to change how I feel.
Janie looks at him, eyes bleak and shining with tears.
Also hating on myself for letting Olivia do all the heavy lifting while I stayed in California.
As a trained detective, I deduce you were trying to save your marriage.
She gives him a wan smile. You're a good guy, Bill. Go on and use the bathroom.
When he comes back, she's curled up in bed again. He puts his arms around her, and they sleep spoons the rest of the night. 25. Early on Sunday morning, before taking her shower, Janie shows him how to use her iPad. Hodges ducks beneath Debbie's blue umbrella and finds a new message from Mr. Mercedes. It's short and to the point.
I'm going to fuck you up, Grandpa.
Yeah, but tell me how you really feel, he says, and surprises himself by laughing. Janie comes out of the bathroom wrapped in a towel, steam billowing around her like a Hollywood special effect. She asks him what he's laughing about. Hodges shows her the message. She doesn't find it so funny.
I hope you know what you're doing.
Hodges hopes so, too. But one thing he's sure, when he gets back home, he'll take the Glock 40 he carried on the job out of his bedroom safe and start carrying it again. The happy slapper is no longer enough. The phone next to the double bed warbles. Janie answers, converses briefly, hangs up.
That was Aunt Charlotte. She suggests the fun crew meet for breakfast in 20 minutes. I think she's anxious to get to Sugar Heights and start checking the silverware.
Okay.
She also shared that the bed was much too hard, and she had to take an allergy pill because of the foam pillows.
Uh-huh. Janie, is Olivia's computer still at the Sugar Heights house?
Sure. In the room she used for her study.
Can you lock that room so they can't get in there?
She pauses in the act of hooking her bra.
For a moment frozen in that pose, elbows back, a female archetype.
Hell with that. I'll just tell them to keep out. I am not going to be intimidated by that woman. And what about Holly? Can you understand anything she says?
I thought she ordered a sneeze bagel for dinner, Hodges admits. Janie collapses into the chair he awoke to find her crying in last night, only now she's laughing.
Sweetie, you're one bad detective, which in this sense means good.
Once the funeral stuff is over and they're gone...
Thursday at the latest, she says. If they stay longer, I'll have to kill them.
And no jury on earth would convict you. Once they're gone, I want to bring my friend Jerome in to look at that computer. I'd bring him in sooner, but...
They'd be all over him, and me.
Hodges, thinking of Aunt Charlotte's bright and inquisitive eyes, agrees.
Won't the blue umbrella stuff be gone? I thought it disappeared every time you left the site.
It's not Debbie's blue umbrella I'm interested in. It's the ghosts your sister heard in the night. 26. As they walk down to the elevator, he asks Janie something that's been troubling him ever since she called yesterday afternoon. Do you think the questions about Olivia brought on your mother's stroke?
She shrugs, looking unhappy. There's no way to tell. She was very old, at least 7 years older than Aunt Charlotte, I think.
and the constant pain beat her up pretty badly. Then, reluctantly, it could have played a part.
Hodges runs a hand through his hastily combed hair, mussing it again. Ah, Jesus. The elevator dings. They step in. She turns to him and grabs both of his hands. Her voice is swift and urgent.
I'll tell you something, though. If I had to do it over again, I still would. Mom had a long life. Ollie, on the other hand, deserved a few more years. She wasn't terribly happy, but she was doing okay until that bastard got to her. That cuckoo bird. Stealing her car and using it to kill 8 people and hurt I don't know how many more wasn't enough for him, was it? Oh no, he had to steal her mind.
So we push forward.
God damn right we do. Her hands tighten on his. This is ours, Bill. Do you get that? This is ours.
He wouldn't have stopped anyway. The bit is in his teeth, but the vehemence of her reply is good to hear.
The elevator doors open. Holly, Aunt Charlotte, and Uncle Henry are waiting in the lobby. Aunt Charlotte regards them with her inquisitive crow's eyes, probably prospecting for what Hodges' old partner used to call the freshly fucked look. She asks what took them so long, then, without waiting for an answer, tells them that the breakfast buffet looks very thin. If they were hoping for an omelet to order, they're out of luck. Hodges thinks that Janie Patterson is in for several very long days. 27. Like the day before, Sunday is brilliant and summery. Like the day before, Brady sells out by 4, at least 2 hours before dinner time approaches and the parks begin emptying. He thinks about calling home and finding out what his mom wants for supper, then decides to grab takeout from Long John Silver's and surprise her. She loves the Langostino lobster bites. As it turns out, Brady is the one surprised. He comes into the house from the garage, and his greeting, "Hey, Mom, I'm home," dies on his lips. This time, she's remembered to turn off the stove, but the smell of the meat she charred for her lunch hangs in the air. From the living room, there comes a muffled drumming sound and a strange gurgling cry. There's a skillet on one of the front burners. He peers into it and sees crumbles of burnt hamburger rising like small volcanic islands from a film of congealed grease. On the counter is a half-empty bottle of Stoli and a jar of mayonnaise, which is all she ever uses to dress her hamburgers. The grease-spotted takeout bags drop from his hands. Brady doesn't even notice. No, he thinks, it can't be. It is, though. He throws open the kitchen refrigerator, and there on the top shelf is the baggie of poisoned meat. Only now, half of it is gone. He stares at it stupidly, thinking, she never checks the mini-fridge in the garage. Never! That's mine! This is followed by another thought. How do you know what she checks when you're not here? For all you know, she's been through all your drawers and looked under your mattress. That gurgling cry comes again. Brady runs for the living room, kicking one of the Long John Silver's bags under the kitchen table and leaving the refrigerator door open. His mother is sitting bolt upright on the couch. She's in her blue silk lounging pajamas. The shirt is covered with a bib of blood-streaked vomit. Her belly protrudes, straining the buttons. It's the belly of a woman who is 7 months pregnant. Her hair stands out from her parchment-pale face in a mad spray. Her nostrils are clotted with blood. Her eyes bulge. She's not seeing him, or so he thinks at first, but then she holds out her hands. Mom! Mom! His initial idea is to thump her on the back, but he looks at the mostly eaten hamburger on the coffee table next to the remains of what must have been a perfectly enormous screwdriver and knows back thumps will do no good. The stuff's not lodged in her throat. If only it were. The drumming sound he heard when he came in recommences as her feet begin to piston up and down. It's as if she's marching in place. Her back arches. Her arms fly straight up. Now she's simultaneously marching and signaling that the field goal is good. One foot shoots out and kicks the coffee table. Her screwdriver glass falls over. Mom! She throws herself back against the sofa cushions, then forward. Her agonized eyes stare at him. She gurgles a muffled something that might or might not be his name. What do you do for poisoning victims? Was it raw eggs? Or Coca-Cola? No, Coke's for upset stomachs, and she's gone far beyond that. Have to stick my fingers down her throat, he thinks. Make her gag it up. But then her teeth begin doing their own march, and he pulls his tentatively extended hand back, pressing the palm over his mouth instead. He sees that she has already bitten her lower lip almost to tatters. That's where the blood on her shirt has come from, some of it anyway.
Bravy!
She draws in a hitching breath. What follows is guttural but understandable.
Call 911.
Call 911. He goes to the phone and picks it up before realizing he really can't do that. Think of the unanswerable questions that would ensue. He puts it back down and whirls to her.
Why did you go snooping out there, Mom? Why?
Bravy! 911!
When did you eat it? How long has it been?
Instead of answering, she begins to march again. Her head snaps up, and her bulging eyes regard the ceiling for a second or two before her head snaps forward again. Her back doesn't move at all. It's as if her head is mounted on bearings. The gurgling sounds return. The sound of water trying to go down a partially clogged drain. Her mouth yawns, and she belches vomit. It lands in her lap with a wet splat, and oh God, it's half blood. He thinks of all the times he's wished her dead. But I never wanted it to be like this, he thinks. Never like this. An idea lights up his mind like a single bright flare over a stormy ocean. He can find out how to treat her online. Everything's online. I'm going to take care of it, he says, but I have to go downstairs for a few minutes. You hang in there, Mom. Try, he almost says, try to relax. He runs into the kitchen toward the door that leads to his control room. Down there, he'll find out how to save her. And even if he can't, he won't have to watch her die. 28. The word to turn on the lights is control, but although he speaks it three times, the basement remains in darkness. Brady realizes the voice recognition program isn't working because he doesn't sound like himself, and is it any wonder? Any fucking wonder at all? He uses the switch instead and goes down, first shutting the door and the beastly sounds coming from the living room behind him. He doesn't even try to voice act his bank of computers, just turns on his number 3 with the button behind the monitor. The countdown to total erasure appears, and he stops it by typing in his password. But he doesn't seek out poison antidotes. It's far too late for that. And now that he's sitting here in his safe place, he allows himself to know it. He also knows how this happened. She was good yesterday, staying sober long enough to make a nice supper for them, so she rewarded herself today. Got schnockered, then decided she'd better eat a little something to soak up the booze before her honey boy got home. Didn't find anything in the pantry or the refrigerator that tickled her fancy. Oh, but say, what about the mini-fridge in the garage? Soft drinks wouldn't interest her, but perhaps there were snacks. Only what she found was even better. A baggie filled with nice, fresh hamburger. It makes Brady think of an old saying, whatever can go wrong, will go wrong. Is that the Peter principle? He goes online to find out. After some investigation, he discovers it's not the Peter principle, but Murphy's Law, named after a man named Edward Murphy. The guy made aircraft parts. Who knew? He surfs a few other sites, actually quite a few, and plays a few hands of solitaire. When there's a particularly loud thump from upstairs, he decides to listen to a few tunes on his iPod. Something cheery. The Staple Singers, maybe. And as Respect Yourself
plays in the middle of his head. He goes on Debbie's blue umbrella to see if there's a message from the fat ex-cop. 29. When he can put it off no longer, Brady creeps upstairs. Twilight has come. The smell of seared hamburger is almost gone, but the smell of puke is still strong. He goes into the living room. His mother is on the floor next to the coffee table, which is now overturned. Her eyes glare up at the ceiling. Her lips are pulled back in a great big grin. Her hands are claws. She's dead. Brady thinks,
"Why did you have to go out in the garage when you got hungry? Oh, Mom, Mommy, what in God's name possessed you? Whatever can go wrong will go wrong," he thinks. And then, looking at the mess she's made, he wonders if they have any carpet cleaner. This is Hodge's fault. It all leads back to him. He'll deal with the old debt rat, and soon. Right now, though, he has a more pressing problem. He sits down to consider it, taking the chair he uses on the occasions when he watches TV with her. He realizes she'll never watch another reality show. It's sad, but it does have its funny side. He imagines Jeff Probst sending flowers with a card reading, "From all your survivor pals," and he just has to chuckle. What is he to do with her? The neighbors won't miss her because she never ever had anything to do with them, called them stuck up. She has no friends either, not even of the barfly type, because she did all her drinking at home. Once, in a rare moment of self-appraisal, she told him she didn't go out to the bars because they were full of drunks just like her. "That's why you didn't taste that shit and stop, isn't it?" he asked the corpse. "You were too fucking loaded." He wishes they had a freezer case. If they did, he'd cram her body into it. He saw that in a movie once. He doesn't dare put her in the garage. That seems a little too public, somehow. He supposes he could wrap her in a rug and take her down to the basement. She'd certainly fit under the stairs. But how would he get any work done knowing she was there? Knowing that, even inside a roll of rug, her eyes were glaring. Besides, the basement's his place, his control room. In the end, he realizes there's only one thing to do. He grabs her under the arms and drags her toward the stairs. By the time he gets her there, her pajama pants have slid down, revealing what she sometimes called, he reminds himself, her winky. Once, when he was in bed with her, and she was giving him relief for a particularly bad headache, he tried to touch her winky, and she slapped his hand away, hard. "Don't you ever," she had said. "That's where you came from." Brady pulls her up the stairs a riser at a time. The pajama pants work down to her ankles and puddle there. He remembers how she did a sit-down march on the couch in her last extremity. How awful. But like the thing about Jeff Probst sending flowers, it had its funny side, although it wasn't the kind of joke you could explain to people. It was kind of zen. Down the hall, into her bedroom, he straightens up, wincing at the pain in his lower back. God, she's so heavy. It's as if death has stuffed her with some dense mystery meat. Never mind. Get it done. He yanks up her pants, making her decent again, as decent as a corpse in vomit-soaked PJs can be, and lifts her onto her bed, groaning as fresh pain settles into his back. When he straightens up this time, he can feel his spine crackling. He thinks about taking off her nightclothes and replacing them with something clean, one of the XL t-shirts she sometimes wears to bed, maybe, but that would mean more lifting and manipulation of what is now just pounds of silent flesh hanging from bone coat hangers. What if he threw his back out? He could at least take off her top. That caught most of the mess, but then he'd have to look at her boobs. Those she did let him touch, but only once in a while. "My handsome boy," she'd say on these occasions, running her fingers through his hair, or massaging his neck where the headache settled,
crouched and snarling. My handsome honey boy.
In the end, he just pulls the bedspread up, covering her entirely, especially those staring, glaring eyes.
Sorry, Mom, he says, looking down at the white shape. Not your fault.
No. It's the FedEx cop's fault. Brady bought the go-for-go to poison the dog, true, but only as a way of getting to Hodges and messing with his head. Now it's Brady's head that's a mess, not to mention the living room. He's got a lot of work to do down there, but he has something else to do first.
30. He's got control of himself again, and this time his voice commands work. He doesn't waste time, just sits down in front of his number 3 and logs on to Debbie's blue umbrella. His message to Hodges is brief and to the point. I'm going to kill you. You won't see me coming.
Call for the dead. 1. On Monday, 2 days after Elizabeth Wharton's death, Hodges is once more seated in DiMaggio's Italian Ristorante. The last time he was here, it was for lunch with his old partner. This time it's dinner. His companions are Jerome Robinson and Janelle Patterson. Janie compliments him on his suit, which already fits better even though he's only lost a few pounds, and the Glock he's wearing on his hip hardly shows at all. It's the new hat Jerome likes, a brown fedora Janie bought Hodges on impulse that very day and presented to him with some ceremony. Because he's a private detective now, she said, and every private dick should have a fedora he can pull down to one eyebrow. Jerome tries it on and gives it that exact tilt.
What do you think? Do I look like Bogey?
I hate to disappoint you, Hodges says, but Bogey was Caucasian.
So Caucasian he practically shimmered, Janie adds.
Forgot that. Jerome tosses the hat back to Hodges, who places it under his chair, reminding himself not to forget it when he leaves, or step on it. He's pleased when his 2 dinner guests take to each other at once. Jerome, an old head on top of a young body, Hodges often thinks, does the right thing as soon as the ice-breaking foolishness of the hat is finished, taking one of Janie's hands in both of his and telling her he's sorry for her loss.
Both of them, he says. I know you lost your sister, too. If I lost mine, I'd be the saddest guy on earth. Barb's a pain, but I love her to death. She thanks him with a smile. Because Jerome's still too young for a legal glass of wine, they all order iced tea. Janie asks him about his college plans, and when Jerome mentions the possibility of Harvard, she rolls her eyes and says, a Harvard man? Oh my God. Massa Hodges gonna have to find himself a new lawn boy, Jerome exclaims, and Janie laughs so hard she has to spit a bite of shrimp into her napkin. It makes her blush, but Hodges is glad to hear that laugh. Her carefully applied makeup can't completely hide the pallor of her cheeks or the dark circles under her eyes. When he asks her how Aunt Charlotte, Uncle Henry, and Holly the Mumbler are enjoying the big house in Sugar Heights, Janie grabs the sides of her head as if afflicted with a monster headache. Aunt Charlotte called 6 times today. I'm not exaggerating, 6. The first time was to tell me that Holly woke up in the middle of the night, didn't know where she was, and had a panic attack. Auntie C said she was on the verge of calling an ambulance when Uncle Henry finally got her settled down by talking to her about NASCAR. She's crazy about stock car racing. Never misses it on TV, I understand. Jeff Gordon is her idol, Janie shrugs. Go figure. How old is this Holly? Jerome asks. About my age, but she suffers from a certain amount of emotional retardation, I guess you'd say.
Jerome considers this silently, then says, she probably needs to reconsider Kyle Busch.
Who?
Never mind.
Janie says Aunt Charlotte has also called to marvel over the monthly electrical bill, which must be huge, to confide that the neighbors seem very standoffish, to announce there is an awfully large number of pictures and all that modern art is not to her taste, to point out, although it sounds like another announcement, that if Olivia thought all those lamps were carnival glass, she had almost certainly been taken to the cleaners. The last call,
received just before Janie left for the restaurant, had been the most aggravating. Uncle Henry wanted Janie to know, her aunt said, that he had looked into the matter and it still wasn't too late to change her mind about the cremation. She said the idea made her brother very upset. He called it a Viking funeral, and Holly wouldn't even discuss it because it gave her the horrors. Their Thursday departure is confirmed, Janie says, and I'm already counting the minutes. She squeezes Hodge's hand and says, there's one bit of good news, though. Auntie C says that Holly was very taken with you.
Hodges smiles. Must be my resemblance to Jeff Gordon.
Janie and Jerome order dessert. Hodges, feeling virtuous, does not. Then, over coffee, he gets down to business. He has brought two folders with him and hands one to each of his dinner companions.
All my notes. I've organized them as well as I can. I want you to have them in case anything happens to me.
Janie looks alarmed. What else has he said to you on that site?
Nothing at all, Hodges says. The lie comes out smoothly and convincingly. It's just a precaution.
You sure of that? Jerome asks.
Absolutely. There's nothing definitive in the notes, but that doesn't mean we haven't made progress. I see a path of investigation that might, I repeat, might take us to this guy. In the meantime, it's important that you both remain very aware of what's going on around you at all times.
Bolo our asses off, Janie says.
Right, he turns to Jerome. And what specifically are you going to be on the lookout for?
The reply is quick and sure. Repeat vehicles, especially those driven by males on the younger side, say between the ages of 25 and 40. Although I think 40's pretty old, which makes you practically ancient, Bill.
Nobody loves a smartass, Hodges says. Experience will teach you that in time, young man.
Elaine, the hostess, drifts over to ask how everything was. They tell her everything was fine, and Hodges asks for more coffee all around. Right away, she says. You're looking much better than the last time you were here, Mr. Hodges, if you don't mind me saying so.
Hodges doesn't mind. He feels better than the last time he was here. Lighter than the loss of 7 or 8 pounds can account for.
When Elaine's gone and the waitress has poured more coffee, Janie leans over the table with her eyes fixed on his. What path? Tell us.
He finds himself thinking of Donald Davis, who has confessed to killing not only his wife but 5 other women at rest stops along the highways of the Midwest. Soon the handsome Mr. Davis will be in state where he will no doubt spend the rest of his life.
Hodges has seen it all before.
He's not so naive as to believe that every homicide is solved, but more often than not, murder does out. Something, a certain wifely body in a certain abandoned gravel pit, for instance, comes to light. It's as if there's a fumble-fingered but powerful universal force at work, always trying to put wrong things right. The detectives assigned to a murder case read reports, interview witnesses, work the phones, study forensic evidence, and wait for that force to do its job. When it does, if it does, a path appears. It often leads straight to the doer, the sort of person Mr. Mercedes refers to in his letters as a perk. Hodges asks his dinner companions, what if Olivia Trelawney actually did hear ghosts?
2. In the parking lot, standing next to the used but serviceable Jeep Wrangler his parents gave him as a 17th birthday present, Jerome tells Janie how good it was to meet her and kisses her cheek. She looks surprised but pleased. Jerome turns to Hodges. You all set, Bill? Need anything tomorrow?
Just for you to look into that stuff we talked about so you'll be ready when we check out Olivia's computer.
I'm all over it.
Good. And don't forget to give my best to your dad and mom.
Jerome grins. Tell you what, I'll pass your best on to dad. As for mom, Tyrone Feelgood Delight makes a brief cameo appearance. I'll be stepping round that lady for the next week or so.
Hodges raises his eyebrows. Are you in Dutch with your mother? That doesn't sound like you.
Nah, she's just grouchy. And I can relate, Jerome snickers.
What are you talking about?
Oh, man, there's a concert at the Mac Thursday night. This dopey boy band called Round Here. Barb and her friend Hilda and a couple of their other friends are insane to see them, although they're as vanilla pudding as can be.
How old's your sister? Janie asks. 9, going on 10. Vanilla pudding's what girls that age like. Take it from a former 11-year-old who was crazy about the Bay City Rollers.
Jerome looks puzzled and she laughs.
If you knew who they were, I'd lose all respect for you.
Anyway, none of them have ever been to a live show, right? I mean, other than Barney or Sesame Street on Ice or something. So they pestered and pestered, they even pestered me, and finally the moms got together and decided that since it was an early show, the girls could go even if it was a school night as long as one of them did the chaperone thing. They literally drew straws, and my mom lost.
He shakes his head. His face is solemn, but his eyes are sparkling.
My mom at the Mac with 3,000 or 4,000 screaming girls between the ages of 8 and 14. Do I have to explain any more about why I'm keeping out of her way?
I bet she has a great time, Janie says. She probably screamed for Marvin Gaye or Al Green not so long ago.
Jerome hops into his Wrangler, gives them a final wave, and pulls out onto Lowbriar. That leaves Hodges and Janie standing beside Hodges' car, in an almost summer night. A quarter moon has risen above the underpass that separates the more affluent part of the city from Lowtown.
He's a good guy, Janie says. You're lucky to have him.
Yeah, Hodges says. I am.
She takes the fedora off his head and puts it on her own, giving it a small but provocative tilt.
What's next, detective? Your place?
Do you mean what I hope you mean?
I don't want to sleep alone. She stands on tiptoe to return his hat. If I must surrender my body to make sure that doesn't happen, I suppose I must.
Hodges pushes the button that unlocks his car and says, "Never let it be said I failed to take advantage of a lady in distress."
You are no gentleman, sir, she says, then adds, "Thank God, let's go."
3. It's better this time because they know each other a little. Anxiety has been replaced by eagerness. When the lovemaking is done, she slips into one of his shirts. It's so big her breasts disappear completely and the tails hang down to the backs of her knees, and explores his small house. He trails her a bit anxiously. She renders her verdict after they've returned to the bedroom.
Not bad for a bachelor pad. No dirty dishes in the sink, no hair in the bathtub, no porn videos on top of the TV. I even spied a green vegetable or two in the crisper, which earns you bonus points.
She's filched 2 cans of beer from the fridge and touches hers to his.
I never expected to be here with another woman, Hodges says, except maybe for my daughter. We talk on the phone and email, but Allie hasn't actually visited in a couple of years.
Did she take your ex's side in the divorce?
I suppose she did.
Hodges has never thought about it in exactly those terms.
If so, she was probably right too.
You might be too hard on yourself.
Hodges sips his beer. It tastes pretty good. As he sips again, a thought occurs to him.
Does Aunt Charlotte have this number, Janie?
No way. That's not the reason I wanted to come here instead of going back to the condo, but I'd be a liar if I said it never crossed my mind.
She looks at him gravely.
Will you come to the memorial service on Wednesday? Say you will. Please. I need a friend.
Of course. I'll be at the viewing on Tuesday as well.
She looks surprised, but happily so. That seems above and beyond.
Not to Hodges, it doesn't. He's in full investigative mode now, and attending the funeral of someone involved in a murder case, even peripherally, is standard police procedure. He doesn't really believe Mr. Mercedes will turn up at either the viewing or the service on Wednesday, but it's not out of the question. Hodges hasn't seen today's paper, but some alert reporter might well have linked Mrs. Wharton and Olivia Trelawney, the daughter who committed suicide after her car was used as a murder weapon. Such a connection is hardly news, but you could say the same about Lindsay Lohan's adventures with drugs and alcohol. Hodges thinks there might at least have been a sidebar.
I want to be there, he says. What's the deal with the ashes?
The mortician called them the cremains, she says, and wrinkles her nose the way she does when she mocks his yeah. Is that gross or what? It sounds like something you'd pour in your coffee. On the upside, I'm pretty sure I won't have to fight Aunt Charlotte or Uncle Henry for them.
No, you won't have to do that.
Is there going to be a reception?
Janie sighs. Auntie C insists. So the service at 10, followed by a luncheon at the house in Sugar Heights. While we're eating